Thank you, Brad. Can everybody hear me okay? Because I'll probably walk around a fair bit. I'm not very stationary when I speak. And so Brad's right. Yeah, I've been in the business for, well, in the home office business for 25 years. Grew up on a small dairy farm, north central Indiana. Was in everybody's favorite oxymoron for 16 years, military intelligence. Then I wised up. I ended up going to law school. And a father of two. I have a son currently in the Air Force Academy over in Colorado Springs. And a daughter who's a senior in college up in Minnesota. One America, for those of you who are not familiar with us, we are a mutual organization, enterprise that has been around for 140 years. If you've ever sold with Pioneer Mutual or State Life or American United Life, done any 401k plans with our brokerage outfit, then you've experienced us. Any of you who've ever sold any of the Care Solutions product line will be familiar with us. But a Midwest mutual insurance organization, like I say, that I have been with for 25 years. And there's my contact information, the handout you have. Just basically, it's the slides I'm going to go through today. I know that I have a difficult task in front of me because I've been doing this for 25 years, and when you talk to a group of adults after a nice lunch, and you're going to talk about insurance and tax law, I've got a very good friend in Indianapolis, an attorney who does a lot of public speaking at like local fraternal organizations, and he spoke at one about a week and a half ago, did a luncheon meeting, and he spoke on estate planning, and when he got done, one of the old ladies that had been in the audience walked up to him and said, I want you to know that if I only had 30 minutes left to live, I'd like to hear your presentation all over again. And he said, lady, if you only had a half an hour to live, why would you want to spend it listening to me talk about estate planning? And she said, because it would seem like an eternity. So, hopefully it will not seem like an eternity. What we have for you, once we get past the disclaimers and all the stuff that legal tells me I need to tell you, is we're going to get back into an old-fashioned insurance review course. When I started, we had a lot of old, just grand old guys in the business who helped me get started when I started a long time ago. The old NAFA, and back then, it was, rather than the Society of SFP, it was the CLU-CHFC Society. And, you know, they would have courses to help you through the CLU-CHFC. And it was all very good. I think the industry's kind of gotten away from that a little bit. But I think just good straight review and education is very positive to get. For many of you who've been in the business a long time, all this will be review. For some of you newer people, it'll be brand new stuff. And for you, I'm glad you're here. I always have felt that in our industry, there's not a lot that is truly rocket science, if you will. But there are a lot of rules. There are a lot of things to keep straight. There's a lot of dotting I's and crossing T's that you need to get right. And in our industry, that's very important because if a $1 million death benefit doesn't go where the insured intended it to go, you fail, right? So this is a course on dotting I's and crossing T's and doing it right. And these are the 10 things we're going to talk about. So the first one is, I say, mistake number one, not understanding the rule of the Goodman case, also known as three-corner life insurance policy, anytime you have a separate owner, insured, and the beneficiary. It's from the case Goodman versus Commissioner, a federal case back in 1946, which basically held that any time a life insurance policy has three parties involved as an owner, insured, and beneficiary, there is potential for an inadvertent gift by the owner of the entire proceeds at the insured's death. So for example, husband is insured, wife is owner, beneficiary is son. When husband dies, wife has made a gift of the death proceeds to the son. Now, why is that a big deal? Well, we can shelter up now, currently, to $5,490,000 per individual from federal estate taxes. For a couple, we can do almost $11 million. But let's say it's a very wealthy family and it's a $5 million death benefit. Now, you've just inadvertently consumed almost her entire shelter amount. So in many cases, if you end up with something like this, it may ultimately not make a difference in estates that aren't that large, but they need to know what is going on. If the policy owner is not the insured, the owner should be the policy beneficiary. Where I see a big mistake a lot of times is in buy-sell agreements, where you'll have partners maybe cross-purchase on each other. So let's say Brad and I have a business and I buy a policy on him to buy out his shares of death, and he buys a policy on me to buy out my shares. But then we start overthinking the issue, and I say, well, ultimately it's just going to go to your wife anyway, so I'll just make your wife the beneficiary. Boom. We've now run into the Goodman rule, okay? Don't go messing around with your standard buy-sell arrangements. They're set up that way for a reason. You don't want to inadvertently use somebody's shelter amount unified credit if you don't have to. Okay, number two, not understanding the transfer for value rule. That's in section 101A of the Internal Revenue Code, and it provides that proceeds received by the reason of the death of the insured are excluded from income. Now that's the tax-free part of life insurance, right? And you know, our code is not a code of affirmation, right? The Internal Revenue Code is a code of exclusion. Basically, the very first paragraph of the Internal Revenue Code says, from this point on, any accession to wealth you have is taxable, unless in the following 7,200 pages we say otherwise, right? It's a code of exclusion, right? So this is one exclusion, that your life insurance death proceeds are received income tax-free. But then we have an exclusion to the exclusion. And so we say, however, if after issuance of the policy it is transferred for a valuable consideration, then the income exclusion is lost. That's 101A2. So beneficiary includes income in the death proceeds at death less the consideration paid for the contract. Gifts are not transferred for value. Value is presumed in the business setting. We'll talk about that. And a collateral assignment is not a transfer for value. So it gets into a little detail here. Exceptions to the transfer for value rule are to the insured, to a partner of the insured, to a partnership, including the insured, to a corporation of which the insured is an officer and shareholder, and any transferee who determines basis in all or part by reference to the transfer or basis. This is your gift. Also remember, a gift, like to a son, family member, in that gift setting, that intra-family transfer setting, there's no value presumed. Anytime a policy transfers, however, in the business setting, value is presumed. I don't care if they actually intended it to be a gift to another owner of the business. Value is presumed in the business setting, okay? Last one here, we say note to a co-shareholder or a transfer to a co-shareholder is not an exception to the transfer for value rule. So where this comes into play, a lot of times I get a call, agent will say, you know, went in to see a guy I've known for years and years. He's got a partnership with another guy, and the attorney said, you know, you're big enough now, you need to do a buy-sell arrangement, you need to get some insurance on it. And so their question is, how do I fill out the apps? What do I do? Who do I make the owner? And the answer is, of course, my favorite legal answer, it all depends, right? But then you talk about it, if it's a C corporation or an S corporation, and you don't know exactly how they're going to do the arrangement yet. Because my first question in any setting is, how do they do business? Right? You deal with any advanced sales department, their first question to you in a business case, no matter what it is how do they do business? Are they a C? Are they an S? Are they LLC? Are they a partnership? Because that drives so many of your other decisions. So just mark that down. Number one question in the business setting is how you do business. So now once you've determined that with our owners now, and with this case, with the cross purchase, you say, okay, how are you going to do it? Are you going to have the corporation redeem the shares of a deceased owner? Are you going to have the surviving owners buy directly from the deceased owner's estate? What are you going to do? And a lot of times they'll say, well, we really don't know. What do you suggest? And then we'll talk about the issues. If they want to get underwriting underway, what I tell them is, if it's a corporation, have them do the cross purchase. In other words, have the partners own on each other, shareholders own on each other. Because you can transfer into a corporation, but you can't transfer to a co-shareholder. So if you start with the corporation owning and they end up doing a cross purchase, remember in the cross purchase setting, you're transferring to somebody who isn't the insured. And so you run afoul of this right here. So just pack that away. That's the one place where I see most of the problems with the transfer for value rule is that very bottom thing. And a lot of times it arose because they wanted to get underwriting started before they really knew what final form the buy-sell was going to take. Okay, number three, mishandling policies with loans. And I see this all the time. Creating phantom income by surrendering a policy subject to an outstanding loan or letting such a policy lapse. Or Section 1035 of a policy subject to an outstanding loan. Or giving a policy subject to an outstanding loan. And you say, well, why does it matter? The amount realized from the sale or disposition of a policy includes the amount of any policy loan that is discharged as a result of the transaction. Basically, the rule of thumb is when you look at if there's any tax on the surrender or the lapse of a life insurance policy, you look at everything the person put into it, and you compare it to everything they get out of it. So what do you put in the policy? Well, that's your premium, right? So normally, that's going to be your basis in the policy. Now, if dividends paid some premium, or hey, you might have an adjustment downward, you're your basis. But basically, everything that you put in the policy, that's your basis. That's your premium. What do you get out of a policy? Well, whatever you get on surrender, if you surrender it, you get zero on lapse, obviously. And what else do you get out? Well, you get dividends, right? They are going to reduce basis. Your basis will stay the same if they come out and they go to pay premium. Then it's a wash. But what else comes out? Loans and loan interest. That's something you got out of a policy. And if that loan is extinguished when the policy lapses, you include that. That's part of what you include in what you got. Okay? So let's say I've got $10,000 of premium put in, and let's say I've got $12,000 of total cash value in the policy and a $5,000 loan. Right? And so on surrender, I'm going to get $7,000. But you add the loan and the loaners back in, when I compare that to my $10,000, what do I have? I have $2,000 gain. Right? And so people don't realize that. And you get into large policies, obviously you can talk about really large numbers. So we always say, you know, the standard rule on cash value life insurance, surrender the basis, switch to loans. That's how you do your standard retirement plan, right? You're surrendering your paid up ads, what you can in the policy, depending on its configuration, and then you switch to loans at basis. Because fundamentally, on a life insurance policy, it's the only thing really out there left that's FIFO, right? First in, first out. You know, if you take anything other than a loan, you take a dividend, you take a withdrawal, that's first treated as a return of premium, that's not taxable. Until what? Until you get to basis, right? And then if you withdraw beyond basis, you start paying income tax. However, a loan on a life insurance policy is considered what? An advancement of the death benefit, right? And the death benefit is income tax-free. So we're talking about something that's an advancement of something that's in income tax-free, so it's income tax-free. So you always hear that phrase, surrender to basis, switch to loans. Well, that's why. And that works great for retirement income, except for one thing. If you improperly manage the policy and the loans get away from you when the policy happens, what do you have? Well, what do you have? Phantom income. So life insurance is a great asset. It is a great asset in retirement. But what you need to make sure that your clients who are engaged in all these techniques with retirement planning and life insurance is they understand they have to manage the policy. You have to make sure that it doesn't lapse. They'll have overloan protection riders on them and lapse protection on them. Varies from carrier to carrier. And that's an attempt to keep us from shooting our own selves in the foot, you know, when you get right down to it. It's where you get taxed, but you actually receive nothing. So in my example where the policy lapsed, I actually got nothing, but I'm going to get a 1099 for $2,000. So hence phantom. Yeah. So, and that's what I say in the second bullet point here. Oh, well, back then, I should have just kept going, right? The discharge loan generates no cash, hence the term phantom income. Okay, there are two views on 1035 exchanges, and this is one of the big mistakes I see, probably more than any other, when it comes to loans. People will exchange life insurance policies that are subject to a loan without realizing what the consequences are. Pardon me, I want to be able to keep speaking. View number one is that if you have a loan discharged on a 1035 exchange, because remember when you exchange a policy, you discharge a loan on the policy as to that insured, that some carriers like at One America, we reduce the basis to zero. and we will only send you a 1099 if the loan amount that you had on the policy that was discharged actually exceeded the premiums you paid, actually exceeded your basis. However, that is not the majority. I would say 85 to 90% of the industry won't treat it that way. If you 1035 a policy with a loan, they will treat the loan proceeds up to the extent there's gain in the policy as taxable income. So let's say I've got, once again, my $10,000 a basis, my $5,000 loan, my $12,000 of cash, so I have $2,000 of gain. With number two, if I 1035 that policy, I'm going to get a 1099 for $2,000. Now, with One America, what you're going to get, and there are very few companies that do that, you're going to get no 1099. The new carrier is simply going to be instructed that the basis is now $7,000, not $10,000 in the policy. The reason most of the industry uses this method is, what does it do? It discourages 1035 exchanges. That's why they do it. And they base this view on Section 1031 being the key of that area of the code, which says anytime you receive anything in excess on an exchange, you treat the excess as boot. So the loan forgiveness is treated as boot and it's considered taxable. Section 1 is based on Section 72 of the code, which governs life insurance and annuity taxation, that says, you know, if you don't have surrender or you don't have otherwise taxable gain, you're not taxed on it. So we have two sections of the code that are actually in conflict. Most of the industry says this is the one that has the trump card. The IRS has actually never specifically ruled on it, though in a couple cases they have said that they feel that 1031 is the section that guides the transaction, and so that gives most of the carriers something to hang their hat on. So, point being, you have somebody who wants to 1035 a life insurance policy that has a loan on it, either have them pay off the loan to get rid of that problem, have them 1035 it, and or have them 1035 and make them understand that they're going to get a 1099 and understand what that amount is going to be. Now, there used to be a few carriers out there who would actually issue a policy with a loan on it. I don't know of anybody out there who's doing that now in the world. I think that I know Lincoln did it for years, but they don't anymore. Does Pru still do it? So you have to deal with that issue. Because, you know, here's the deal. Even if it's a very small 1099, let's say it's a 1099 for only $100, no big deal. If the client didn't expect that that was coming, that's the biggest thing. If you said, hey, there's going to be a taxable event, but it's only, I just want you to know that, and they agree to it, then it's no big deal, right? But clients hate getting tax documents that they weren't expecting. We won't issue one with a loan. No. Well, you can take loans. And oh, another thing, obviously, that can do is, let's say if they want to go to a financial institution, get a loan, pay off the loan on the life policy, have the new policy issued, then surrender our loan from the new policy to pay off the financial institution. That's another thing you can do as well. I've actually seen that done from time to time. But we won't issue a policy with a loan on it to start to avoid that problem. Boot is a tax term that basically, where it originally came up was real estate exchanges. And so, you know, if I'm exchanging one apartment complex for another apartment complex and one has a mortgage on it and the other one doesn't, but they're otherwise the same value, in any exchange I'll say, I'll take over your debt, that's boot. Or I'll give you this house over here because I know you want it and I want to sweeten the pot. It's not a direct exchange. Any value that's deemed to be in excess of what the fair exchange would be is boot. We've seen that if you have a whole life policy that has paid up additions on it and it also has a loan, you don't see that a lot, but if it does, if they have enough paid up assets to pay off a loan, do it, right? Or like I say, otherwise you can just straight pay the loan off. Yeah. Okay, bargain sale rules apply. When you gift a policy with a loan, this comes in with the charitable arena. Basically, the donor is treated as if the donee paid him or her cash equal to the amount of the loan, even though the cash payment, no cash payment actually is made. So back to my example where you've got a policy with a $5,000 loan, you would be treated as selling, if the surrender value was 7 and the loan was 5, you would be treating as selling a $7,000 asset for $5,000. That means instead of giving a $7,000 charitable deduction, you're only getting a $2,000 charitable deduction. And so you have to be aware of that even in the charitable setting. And obviously, if you have, once again, if you have a loan that actually exceeds the investment, now you can generate taxable income to the donor that's over and above what the charitable deduction is. So you get no benefit from it. Okay, number 4, not understanding the modified endowment contract rules. The federal government imposes limits on the amount of premium that can be paid into a policy during its first 7 years. This premium restriction is referred to as the 7-pay limit. Now, I always say, number one, with new agents, remember, there are two issues that you're jumping through when you talk about policy values and determinations. The first one is whether or not it's even life insurance. And that all appears in Section 7702 of the code. That's where your cash value corridor test is and your net cash value test. That's to make sure that your product is even life insurance from the very beginning. In other words, so that the death benefit is income tax free. Once you have something that is life insurance, then in addition to it being life insurance where the death benefit is income tax free, you can put money into it at too fast a rate. And this is something to keep you from basically doing life insurance that's otherwise an annuity, if you will, right? It's something to keep you from putting money into policy too fast where there's virtually very little risk, but you get all the benefits of life insurance. What David McKnight was talking about earlier today, but all the benefits of life insurance, we don't want you to be able to do that and not have that spigot of risk out there running. That's what the MEC test really is all about, making sure you don't treat it too much simply as an investment. So policies that exceed the 7-pay limit are classified as modified endowment contracts. So basically, think of lifetime distributions from MECs as the same as a deferred annuity. Non-qualified deferred annuity, exactly the same taxation you get with a MEC. Now, to remember now that the MEC death benefit is still income tax-free because it's still life insurance under 7702B, so the death benefit is still income tax-free. It's just that your lifetime distributions now are treated exactly like annuities. You get LIFO, last in, first out taxation, rather than FIFO. Loans and assignments are treated as distributions. You know that, right, with a non-qualified annuity. Don't ever let a bank take a collateral assignment on any of your clients' non-qualified annuities, because under the law, what that does is if there's any gain in the annuity, it makes it immediately taxable, okay? So it's the same with a modified endowment contract. Your 10% pre-59 penalty applies, just like it applies to non-qualified annuities and your qualified plans. Also remember, once a MEC, always a MEC. I get this question every now and then. Well, if we put it into another policy that otherwise wouldn't be a MEC, will it be a MEC? And the answer is yes. Once it's a MEC, it's always a MEC. And remember, undistributed gain is still tax deferred. In other words, you don't get taxed as it builds up in the policy. You actually have to have a distribution. You have to have a loan or a withdrawal, and there has to be gain in the contract for it to be taxed. Death benefit is still income tax-free. My own life's an example. I lost my wife to cancer a number of years ago. My kids were fairly small. One of the things I did at that point in time was I bought a big MEC contract. And you say, well, why did you do that? Well, number one, I had the ability to do it, right? I wanted that death benefit. And I knew I wasn't going to use it for cash. I knew it. So I knew it was only going to be used for death benefit. And I kind of use that thing as an anchor in my portfolio because you can't kill it. That thing, it's been in existence now for 10 years and you can't kill that contract. It's fabulous. And of course, now that I'm getting close to my senior years, I'm thinking about 1035-ing that contract because it's got like $80,000 of gain in it, right? Into asset-based long-term care. So I will tell you about MEX. It's not that MEC should be avoided at all cost. It's that MEC should be understood because they do have a place in certain settings, right? And if you understand that you're really only going to be using it for death benefit, then have that. Because most of these MECs come with pretty strong guarantees, especially if it's a whole life policy with a carrier. You know, with us, we'll guarantee the payment for any number of years you want if you say at the beginning, this is how long I'm going to pay. So there is definitely a place for match, but you have to understand how they operate. Right. Now, if they run the test and if the policy as illustrated in the first 7 years in the MAC, it will be what they call a MAC at issue. And so that means your distributions from year one. Now, I don't know if you've ever looked at illustrations from various carriers on whole life policies that allow you to put paid up additions in them. Okay? And you maybe have seen illustrations that'll say this policy becomes a MAC in like year 43 or something like that. And you're like, well, how does that happen? They actually only do the test, at least with most carriers, for the first 7 years. After that, the regs say you don't need to test anymore. But what happens is there's another test out there called necessary premium. And if your policy ever gets to the point where you have enough cash in the policy to actually pay up that death benefit in that year at that time, that's called a material change. And what the rule says, anytime you have a material change in the contract, you have to rerun the MAC test. And of course, on that policy, when you rerun the MAC test, it fails because it's paid up, basically. And so that's where you get that on some illustrations to say, you know, this becomes a MAC in year, you know, 42 or 65 or whatever. I have found on our software at One America that if you take a zero-year-old, you know, take an infant, and you put $1 paid up annual, it'll be a MAC by age 65, you know, with just one bottle. It's simply the way the math works. It's a MAC in any year when it hits that. If you have sufficient death benefit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that's the deal. It's, you made me think of something when you said it, but then it kind of fell back out of my mind. But, the big point is you simply have to understand the taxation. It's not that it's something that needs to be avoided. Right, if you never take any distribution, let's say it becomes a MAC in year 30, but in year 50 you die and it's still income tax-free death benefit. And every now and then I'll get the question, well, let's say it becomes a MAC in year 30 and you've been taking distributions for about 5 years, what happens? The IRS in some of its opinions has basically admitted we know we can't go back more than 3 years. So the worst case scenario is they'll go back and tax you for 3 years of those distributions and you'll have a MAC going forward. That's why sometimes I'll actually show illustrations that say it's a MAC in year 50. The guy's going to be 95 years old. It's kind of like almost, what do I care? He's going to have tax when he's 92, you know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, because if you don't keep adding money like you illustrate, that may never happen. Or your reserving may change. Yeah. Is there another question back there? Right, right. That is an advancement of the death benefit. That's correct. Right, yeah. If you 1035-2-1 with, or if it has the chronic illness or terminal illness rider on it, or if you 1035 it, like I say, what I'm doing into a straight asset-based LTC policy. Yeah. Because that's a qualified long-term care benefit. All those 7702B long-term care benefits, they don't care that it's a MAC. If it's a qualified long-term care benefit, it's income tax-free. So that's a way to avoid the gain. Yeah. No. It's the additional cash. That is correct. Yeah. And normally you have to add a fair bit. If you do base premium plus a quarter for the average healthy insured between the ages of 20 and 50, the policy will never match. But if you do twice the premium, three times the premium, chances are somewhere along the way it's going to matter. Yeah. Mistake number five, I want to move along here. Good questions. I love the interaction. You guys are awake and, yeah, it just makes me feel good. The carrier. Yeah, matter of fact, I forget, was it Guardian about 5 or 6 years ago? One of the carriers, they got fined by the IRS because they found in their systems that their systems weren't properly identifying mechs when they happened in the contract. And they had to correct it. And so the carriers have an interest in making sure that they keep track of that. No, they don't have to do that. They have to notify you if it becomes a MAC. Most carriers, obviously, have a desire to get out in front of it. And so the whole idea is that you might get a letter from the carrier that says, if you put the same premium in this year that you put in last year, be aware, become a MAC. You can avoid MAC by not putting any money into it this year or something like that. Actually, you can get to the point where it might actually be too late. You can't stop it. But in most situations, unless it's really been a lot of extra money going in, you can stop it. Unless you get the necessary premium. Correct. Yeah. Yep. Okay, moving on. Section 1035 exchanges that are done improperly. This is my number 5 mistake. In general, when a permanent life insurance policy is surrendered, the owner must pay ordinary income tax on any gain in the contract. However, Code Section 1035 permits the policy owner to trade certain kinds of contracts for another on a tax-free basis. And so here's my handy dandy little chart. I always say you can go up the tree, you can't go down, right? So life insurance is at the bottom, it's the biggest, covering your whole life. You know, your deferred annuity, shorter terms, that's at the top of the tree. You can go up, you can't come down. So you can go life to life, life to endowment, life to an annuity, life to long-term care, okay? But you can't go back down. You can't go from an annuity back down. Okay, annuity back down to life, you can only go to the same or higher. So just remember that, okay? Life insurance to annuity to long-term care, but you cannot go from annuity to life insurance. Also remember, policies must be exchanged. There is no such thing as a rollover of life insurance policies. Like you think of a rollover with IRAs, where you can actually get a check written out to you, and if within 60 days you take it to another carrier as an IRA, you're okay. You continue your tax deferral. No, you actually have to surrender the policy to the new carrier, and they then exchange it with the old carrier. So it actually has to be an exchange. Can't get a check and reinvest. Single life or survivorship doesn't qualify. So you can go life to life and not life to two lives. However, if you have two lives and one of them dies, what is that now? That's basically a single life policy on the survivor. They can 1035 to a single life policy on their surviving life. If you are a life insurance policy with loans, remember mistake number 3, right? That most carriers are going to treat that loan as boot and tax it to the extent that you have gain in the contract. Number 6, fail to name a contingent beneficiary. If the policy beneficiary predeceases the insured and no contingent beneficiary is named, the policy proceeds will be paid to the insured's estate, subject to creditors of the estate, state death taxes, if any, and delay in expenses of probate. I always say apply something like the rule of 2. You can even make a charity of the backup beneficiary and verify your designations every 3 years. When I practiced law, we even on our law office had something we called tickling the files. And it was every time we went and contacted the client about something. You do much the same in the insurance business, right? When they have a birthday, you send them a card. If they have a child, you check, right? If they become a trustee, if they had a child get married, if they're getting divorced, that's a big one, you better go see them. So all these reasons that I call tickling the file. But beneficiaries is a big part of that. Family situations change. You may have beneficiaries predeceased insured. And once again, like McKnight talked about earlier today, you have this wonderful asset, life insurance, this wonderful asset that has all these things. And all these things in that it's income tax free, and most states make it exempt from their state death taxes, right? It's not subject, it's a non-probate payment, right? So, you know, the doctors that may come after the estate for paying the final medical expenses, they can't go after the named beneficiary of life insurance. That's non-probate. So you have this wonderful asset for leaving a legacy, and you ruin that if it gets paid to the estate. You know, I always said, and once again, it's dotting I's, it's crossing T's, it's the little stuff in the business. But I, for years, I say to agents, your obligation does not end when you walk out the door of the client's house with that initial premium check in hand, right? Because if the death benefit does not get into the hands of the people the insured wanted to get into, you have failed. And this is simply all of these 10 things are really a part of that, of making sure that you do the profession right. And once again, it's more attention to detail than anything that's incomprehensible. It's simply being professional about what you do. Okay, mistake 7, failure to properly set up an irrevocable life insurance trust. If the insured has transferred as a gift any interest in the policy to a third-party owner, such as an islet, within 3 years of death, the policy proceeds will be included in the insured's estate for estate tax purposes. Life insurance is one of the few things out there where there's a three-year rule. You know, 30 years ago, the three-year rule applied to everything, anything you give. But it's long been gone since 1982. Actually, it was longer than 30 years. I lost track of time. I'm getting old. But the only things left on the three-year rule now is that if you pay gift taxes for a gift that you made to somebody that was over the shelter amount, that'll be brought back in. Gifts with what's called a retained interest. And the last one is life insurance. And so if you transfer life insurance to somebody else within 3 years of your death, that death proceeds will be pulled back into your estate. So I say to avoid this rule, have the third-party owner be the initial applicant and owner of the policy. A lot of times I'll get questions, and I understand now that there's a lot less life insurance planning going on now than there was 10, 15 years ago. With the shelter amounts being so high, you know, $11 million for a couple, there's a lot less estate planning being done, especially a lot less in the life insurance trust arena. But I would tell you, I've probably had at least 24 islet cases this year on clients with, you know, if you still bump into them, they're out there $40, $50, $60 million estate. This deal being done, you still need to do all of these cases right. So every now and then I get the question. We want to start the underwriting. We're not sure there might be some health questions. We want to get this process started. If we're not going to get an offer that they're willing to accept, we don't want to go through all the trouble of having the trust drafted. So is there anything we can do to get underwriting underway and avoid the three-year rule? And the answer is yes. Just simply apply for it in their personal name. Name the beneficiaries on the app, the same kids who would be the beneficiaries of the trust. And in your cover letter, I'll just say, hey, make me an offer. And before we'll issue the policy, we will send you another application with a trust as owner. Just do that with your carrier. Some carriers call it a supplemental app. Some will just want a new app. Some call it, a re-app or whatever. But the IRS has held that as long as the first binding premium check comes from the trustee, they don't care how many other apps are out there beforehand, right? So if you ever have that case with an islet and you want to get the underwriting started, just write it in your cover letter. Say, you know, we're going to personally apply right now. These are our beneficiaries. But don't issue it, right? Once we have an offer, if it's accepted, we'll reissue and we'll have a new application with a trust as owner. The other mistakes I see in the life insurance trust arena are these. Failure to send crummy notices. Premium comes directly from the insured and not from the trustee. And the spouse of the insured's trustee is the insured. I can't even talk. In Indiana, we pick on Kentucky. I feel like I moved to Kentucky. I don't know. Do you move to Idaho when you're in Utah? I don't know. Spouse of the insured is trustee without proper restrictions on the trust. The crummy case, which is what, 40, 50 years old now, basically the notice in that case was actually verbal. It wasn't written, but it didn't matter. They proved they were satisfied that notice was given. So you don't actually have to give written notice, but you do have to be able to establish before court if there's litigation that notice was given. So I always say when you're talking about a $10 million policy that may be in or outside of an estate, may be subject to 40% tax or zero tax, make sure they send the crummy letters. That is really a big crossing T, dotting I thing. Just send it. The other one is policy premiums come directly from the insured. always have it run through the trustee. Every now and then the agent will say to me, well, the trust doesn't have a tax account, a tax ID number, and they really don't want to because they know they can use the insured's tax ID while they're living. They don't have a checking account, so do we really have to open one? Well, if that's the case, and if it's a fixed policy, you can't do it with variable because of the SEC rules, but if it's a fixed policy, then just make it payable to the trustee and have the trustee sign it over to the insurance carrier. You can do that. But it's gotta, I think, somehow run through the trustee, because if it doesn't, and you ever do get litigation, the IRS can say, well, this is a sham because we had these crummy notices, which basically said to a beneficiary, you've got 20 days or 30 days or whatever to withdraw this amount, but there was never anything in there to begin with. So how can you say you ran it through the trust when you paid the insurer directly as the insured? So once again, I just say to be safe, make sure it goes through the trustee. Now, if I ask you, how many of you could tell me why crummy powers exist in these trusts? Currently is the word. So most of you are aware that there is this de minimis exclusion to gift taxes, right? I can give up to $14,000 to anybody I want, and I don't have to file a gift tax return, and it doesn't count against my lifetime shelter amount for estate taxes and all that. So it's this $14,000 a year. But what the code says is for me to take advantage of that de minimis exception, the gift has to be a current gift, has to be a present interest gift. So if I throw it into a trust that's paying a trustee and to buy a policy with a death benefit that won't pay my kids maybe for 30, 40, 50 years, is that a present interest? No. So what Crummy did was he said, well, I'm going to put the money in the trust and I'm going to tell the trustee in the trust document, tell my kids they've got 20 days to take it. And if they don't take it, that right lapses. And now then the trustee's going to be using it for life premium. And that's what he did in that case. And the IRS challenged it. They said, well, this is a sham. And the tax court said, no, all the code says is a present interest gift. And for 20 days, it was a present interest gift. Hence, if you've ever heard these old guys talk about an island being a block trust, that's what they're talking about. Because the grantor takes the kids and walks them around the block. And by the time they get done, they know when they get the crummy notice, they're not taking the money, right? But that's the whole point of crummy, is to run it through the trust to get a benefit of the present interest exclusion. It's never been litigated as far as an actual time. They say reasonable. What's reasonable? So is 40, what I see routinely in documents is 30 to 45 days. That's what I routinely see, yeah. Okay, number 8. Yeah, from the notice, yeah. Business-owned life insurance proceeds are payable to a personal beneficiary. I see this way too much as well. It drives me crazy. So let's say you've got a key man policy, or maybe it's one that they also want to use for a stock redemption, and they make it payable to the insured spouse. Don't do that with permanent life insurance, please. Please don't do that. And of course, the reason they do it is they say, well, this is really meant to be a redemption. And if Brad dies, well, the money's going to be with his spouse anyway. So why? And the money's all in the corporation. So let's just have the money, just have the corporation buy the policy and own it, but we'll make his wife the beneficiary because that's where all the money's going to end up anyway. That's the reasoning, right? The problem is Brad's wife is not an employee or owner of the corporation. Corporations are not in the business of making gifts. What do? They provide wages and they provide investment income. So what will happen is that gets litigated and the policies go to Brad's wife. If I'm a shareholder, they're probably treated as a dividend to her, taxable, right? Or if I'm just simply an employee, like a key guy, what was I getting from the business? Compensation. They'll treat it as like a continuation of income and make it subject to ordinary income. Either way, what you've done is you've taken this marvelous tax-free death benefit and now made it taxable. So in that setting, you have to be able to explain in the buy-sell setting, I'll say, well, you understand that the money will go to Brad's estate because the estate will buy from the business, and then she'll get it anyway. So, or you can say, if you really want a situation where you want a spouse or a child to get a tax-free death benefit, but you want the money in the business. And I'll see this a lot in cases where I might normally advise they do a bonus plan, and they say, we want to control the money, the business wants to control the money, we don't want the employee to control it. Well, then if that's the case on a permanent policy, you got to do split dollar. But we do a split dollar, as long as they report that annual economic benefit table 2001, we can make Brad's spouse the beneficiary in that setting. So just understand what's going on there. Yeah. Yeah. I see it a lot. I see the mistake a lot. I really do. Okay, number nine, since we're getting close to the end here. This one here, I call this failure to properly fund the buy-sell agreement. I will tell you this. If you ever run into a situation, and I firmly believe this, where the parties in the business setting, co-shareholders, partners, whatever they are, they say, well, we're doing a binding buy sell, but we're not funding it. I will look them in the eye and say, well, I would rather that you simply not have the buy sell agreement if you're not going to fund it. Brad and I, let's say I put $100,000 into a business, he does, it grows, we're successful, now it's worth $1 million. My value's $500,000, his value's $500,000, right? And we have a binding buy sell, and we have no way of funding it. If I keel over, right? If we don't have a binding buy sell, at least Brad can argue, well, Dave, hey man, he's an old sod, he's a gin drinking old farm. He didn't add anything to the enterprise, right? But if we have a binding buy sell written down, well, he agrees to pay it, doesn't have anything to argue, right? So if they're not gonna fund the buy sell, I would just assume they not have it at all. Because after all, there's only three ways of funding: cash, borrowing, and life insurance. Cash is always what? It's 100 cents in the dollar. I need to pay $500,000. I got to have $500,000 in cash, right? How many people have $500,000 sitting around in the business? They don't, right? So cash is 100 cents in the dollar. What's borrowing? That's 108 cents in the dollar, 116 cents in the dollar, right? Depends. They have to go to a bank and get a loan, right? So that increases the cost. So it's always more with a loan and financing than 100 cents in the dollar, but life insurance is always less than 100 cents on the dollar, right? Unless you had a very thinly funded permanent policy with no extra cash and you live to be 100 years old, you're always going to get more, right? And so why wouldn't you do it? Because we don't know when we're going to die. No. Yeah, that's a good point. If you can't afford the premium, how are we ever going to afford the buyout? Exactly right. So and this isn't really a mistake. It's more of a failure to act. It's a failure to impress upon your business clients the importance of having funding for the buy sell. And then the last one, failure to satisfy the EOLI requirements. These came into effect back in 2006, and I still see mistakes. Anytime you have a policy where a business buys on an employee, okay, and it doesn't matter the type of business, anytime you have a policy, you have to have these notice and consent rules satisfied. The employer has to notify the employee that they're taking out the insurance, what the amount is, and the fact that he can maintain it after the employee leaves, okay? They have to have the employer's signature on it. Without that, if you don't have that, and they die, and you get in litigation with the IRS, and they look for it, it's not there, guess what? Death benefit is taxable. So, once again, a big issue of simply dotting the I, making sure that they have that consent on file. They don't file the consent with the IRS, but they have to have it in their records. And the last one is, it's got to be on a key employee. And the reason this happened is, about 12 years or so ago, there was major litigation. The biggest case was Walmart. Walmart was taking permanent policies out on everybody, the greeter. You know, hi, how are you? I need $500,000 of coverage on it. And what they were doing is they were taking out loans and then deducting the loans, and it was all a big accounting scam, if you will. And the IRS said, you know, we don't like this. And they went to Congress, and at first they said, we want to make old corporate-owned death benefit tax. And the industry said, wait, no, there are a lot of legitimate reasons for corporate-owned policies. Stock redemption, split dollar, key man coverage. And so what you got was really a compromise where they say, okay, we'll allow you to cover key employees, and you got to get consent. And if you do that, it'll stay income tax-free. So what's a key employee? It's a director, 5% owner, or a highly competent individual. This top 35% is kind of your catch-all. If they don't fit anywhere else, if you can put them in there, you're good. I actually had that on a case in Indy. It was a tool and die shop in Indianapolis, and the guy was he was like half blind, but he was a master at what he did, been doing it for years. He was really key to the enterprise, but he was an owner, and he actually wasn't that highly paid, but he was in the top 35% of their payroll by pay. And so we got it covered that way. If you have employers who own life insurance and employees, they have to file that form now, 8925. It's a short form. It's only got 5 lines. You know, your name and address, how many employees you have, do you have life insurance on any of them? If so, in what amount, and do you have consent? It's a 5 lines. So just make sure that they file that form. Now you ask me, well, what happens if they don't file the form? And my answer is, I have no frickin' idea, pardon my French, because the IRS has never said what the penalty for not filing the form is. They just said, we want you to file the form. So if you fail to do the form, does it make the death benefit taxable? Or, I don't know, because there's no penalty stated out there. But once again, to be sure, why wouldn't you tell them to file the form? Because if you do, you're okay. Good question, and I'll end with that, because we've gone over just a hair. So these are your sales that are affected by the COLA. Anytime you do key man, deferred comp funding, entity buy-sell agreements, or endorsement split dollar, make sure in any of those settings that the employer has consent. And I've run into a number of cases where they don't have consent, and the policy was issued 2 or 3 years ago, and they say, well, do we issue a new policy? And what I do, being a practical old Midwesterner, is I look at them and I say, what you need to find in your files is a consent dated by issue of the policy. Now, I'm not telling you what to do, but what you need to find in your files is a consent dated by issue of the policy. You know, it's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest, technically, yes, they should reissue. As a practical matter, is that going to happen, especially if the guy's not insurable anymore? I've never seen one where they intentionally didn't do it. Why would you intentionally not do it? It's a paperwork thing, right? So, but I've always tried to put a measure of practicality, albeit maybe a little scoundrelly, in the way I approach things. Okay, I thank you so much for your attendance. You've been wonderful, wonderful questions.